wherever in the world you are. Welcome to the Health Zone Show with Michal O'Mahuna, where with each episode I explore interesting health and well-being topics with a thought-provoking guest. These topics can range from nutrition, relationships, spirituality, finance, creativity, mental health, and much, much more, so that you can live a healthier, happier, and more authentic life. Guests on the show vary from health experts, spiritual teachers, finance wizards, sports legends, to ordinary people with extraordinary lives. Find us on facebook.com/ The Health Zone Show, or you can also join our Facebook group, The Health Zoners. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, Pinterest under The Health Zone. Check out our new updated website, www.thehealthzoneshow.com, and at the moment, you can receive a free copy of my latest ebook, 7 Ways to Boost Your Overall Well-Being When You Join The Health Zone. Today, I'm chatting with researcher, psychologist, and self-compassion advocate, Dr. Christine Neff. Christine is renowned for her amazing book, Self-Compassion, The Proven Power of Being Kind to Yourself. Dr. Neff will be sharing how people can be kinder to themselves, especially when things get tough. Hello, Christine. How are you today?
Hello, I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. And so tell me, Christine, what does it mean to have self-compassion?
So if you look at the word compassion in the Latin, passion means to suffer, come is with. So it's basically being with your own suffering in a compassionate way, with kindness, warmth, care, and support. So an easy way to think of it is, you know, what does it feel like when you have compassion for a good friend when they're upset or they're feeling badly about themselves or they're having a life challenge? And you think of, well, how am I with a good friend? You know, if I am being compassionate toward them. And then we treat ourselves the same way we treat others we care about.
And what would you consider the foundational pillars of self-compassion, Christine?
So, you know, I actually started researching self-compassion 20 years ago. And so I created a scale to measure. And I had to think of, well, what are the elements of self-compassion that I'm going to measure in my self-compassion scale? And so in the way I look at it, there are three main components. The first is maybe the most obvious, which is the kindness, the warmth I mentioned. But I realized there was also two other elements that are necessary. First is mindfulness, believe it or not. So mindfulness refers to kind of seeing clearly what's happening in the present moment, not turning away from it or getting lost in it. It's kind of having a balanced awareness of what's happening. Now, when we're in pain or when we feel shame or, you know, something's really difficult, often we completely lose our mindfulness. So either we just like shove down any thought. So I'm fine. There's no problem. Right. So we don't face it because we don't want to face it. Or sometimes we do the opposite. We get so lost in it. We get like overwhelmed by our difficult emotions or our feelings of shame that we have no perspective at all anymore. And we need that perspective. We need that balance to be able to say, gosh, I'm really struggling, you know, how can I help myself in the moment? So we need mindfulness. It's really almost the first step before we can even give ourselves compassion. And also really important, what makes it compassion and not pity is a sense of connectedness to larger humanity, right? So if I pity you, you aren't going to like it because I'm like looking down on you. Or if I have self-pity, you know, woe is me, it's actually not very helpful. I'm just wallowing in my pain. But compassion is a connected way of being. It's just framing my difficulty or my mistakes or my imperfection in light of being human. I mean, everyone makes mistakes. Everyone's imperfect. Everyone struggles. Yeah, of course, some more than others. It's not denying that. But, you know, often when we make a mistake or we, you know, feel badly about ourselves or something difficult happens, irrationally, we think, everyone else in the world is living a normal, perfect life, and it's just me who's made this mistake or this blunder, or just me who's feeling this way. And that's like kicking ourselves when we're down, because not only are we hurting, you feel like something's wrong with us. You feel all alone. And so common humanity just kind of frames things really in reality. It's wisdom that, hey, this is part of being human. This is how we learn. This is the plan we signed up for as human beings. There's nothing wrong with making mistakes or having difficulties happen. So those three components, kindness, mindfulness, and common humanity, from my point of view, all need to be there if it's really what I call self-compassion.
And Christine, I know you just mentioned the word wisdom there. Is there a link between self-trust and self-compassion?
So self-trust, I'm just curious, what do you mean by self-trust?
Trusting your inner wisdom, that makes sense.
Yes, absolutely. Interestingly, one of the most powerful findings of the research, and there's a lot of research on self-compassion, is that it leads to greater authenticity. This also leads to greater wisdom. There's some research on that as well. But I think authenticity is very similar to what you're calling self-trust. In other words, you listen, you don't just do what other people say you should do. You aren't totally making decisions based on how much people will like you. You actually make your decisions based on what's true to me. You know, what do I care about? What do I value? What works for me personally? And one of the ways it does that, one of the ways it leads to greater self-trust, it also leads to more self-confidence, which is similar, and this is really key, the sense of self-worth that comes with self-compassion doesn't need to be earned. You don't need to get a graduate degree to have self, that be worthy of compassion. You don't need to like give money to charity. You don't even need to be a good person. The moment we are born, and just imagine seeing a newborn baby, we naturally feel compassion for it. You know, the baby's doing the best it can. It may be crying. It may be pooping its pants. You know, it's like that's the human experience, right? And so this is really the source of the self-worth that's linked to self-compassion. It comes from merely being a flawed human being, doing the best we can moment by moment. And so that unconditional self-worth provides not only stability, it gives us freedom. Again, because we don't have to earn our worth. We don't have to impress people. If we don't have to, look a certain way to be worthy, then that means there's a lot more play to ask ourselves, well, what's important to me? Our sense of self and our worth isn't so contingent on society or other people.
And how come that worth is so contingent in our society?
Well, so normally we base our self-worth is based on self-esteem. And so self-esteem, the word esteem is judgment. You know, you esteem, you evaluate, right? And so we evaluate, am I a good person? Am I a bad person? I'm somewhere in between. And so when self-worth is based on self-esteem, typically in our society, we're told, first of all, we need to be special and above average to be worthy. You know, if I said, hey, you know, this podcast, yeah, it's average, you're going to be kind of hurt. You know, everyone, you say, hey, Kristen, your work, your research is kind of average, I'm going to be hurt. Society tells us to be worthy, we have to be special and above average, which is a problem because that's logically impossible because by definition, only a few people can be above average. So society tells us that we need to be above average. Society also tells us that we need to earn our worth. And by the way, it's kind of a form of control. Like if you think of just the consumer markets, you have to look a certain way. You got to buy my expensive jeans. You got to, you know, get plastic surgery. You got to use makeup. You got to, you know, you got to do whatever. You got to succeed. You got to make the money so that you could buy our products. I mean, society is really set up to get people in line partly by saying, you know, unless you do this, you won't be worthy. And so self-compassion is kind of a radical act. It's saying, my worthiness, you know, this is just an unconditional part of my beingness. And therefore, I'm going to do what's makes me happy. And by the way, you know, the question may be arising, but isn't this selfish? A lot of people think that it's selfish. It's actually not. Okay. First of all, the more compassion flows inward, the more we feel good about ourselves, the more we feel confident and strong. Actually, the more resources we have available to help others is additive. It's not like a zero-sum game. It also gives you the ability to care for others, to give to others without being drained. Because again, you're like filling your own cup with your sense of worthiness and care and kindness. So it actually helps others. It doesn't take away from them.
I know you mentioned there about self-compassion and, you know, having compassion towards ourselves. How important is that we have self-compassion for ourselves so that the love we offer others is genuine and true?
Yeah, I mean, well, that's a good point. Sometimes we're, the love we give is because we want people to like us, right? So it's like, for instance, think about when you criticize yourself in front of us, I'm so stupid. You know, you want them to say, oh, no, you aren't. You know, part of your behavior is, you know, not to judge it, but it's a tiny bit manipulative because we want something. We want people to, and maybe they want people to give us compassion or to give us understanding or to give us some praise, or we want them to like us or to be in good relationship with us. And so, again, if we can get a lot of this from ourselves, just from opening our own hearts to ourselves, our sense of worthiness, you know, the clear constructive feedback, you know, just the understanding, hey, it's okay, I made a mistake. I can learn from this. I can try, you know, try harder next time. It allows for more authentic relationships. And again, there's research to support this. I'm not just making this up. So more authenticity in relationships, which we kind of already talked about. But we did a study of actually 100 romantic couples. And we found that people judged when their partners were more self-compassionate, they judged them to be like more intimate, more authentic, more giving. And they were happier in their relationship when their partners were more self-compassionate. Again, because the more resources you have available for yourself, the more you have available also to give to others. Now, I will say it doesn't seem to be true scientifically that you have to be self-compassionate before being compassionate to others. Because in fact, most people are in this category. A lot of people are like caring, kind, warm, supportive to others. And it's genuine. It's not just manipulative. You know, it's true. And then they treat themselves like hell. So it's not necessary to have compassion for others to be self-compassionate first. But what we know is if you either, if you are more self-compassionate or you're trained in self-compassion, usually your compassion for others increases, your capacity increases. And really important, you're less likely to burn out by caring for others because, again, you're filling your own cup.
And in practicing self-compassion, is there a way someone can differentiate between genuine self-care and, say, avoidance or escapism?
Right. Well, that's a really good question. So sometimes this comes into the kind of approach is, well, can't this just be self-indulgence, right? So I'm just like escaping it. I'm just not really seeing clearly what I need. You know, I'm just going to eat cupcakes all day, or, you know, I'm just going to avoid my problems. You know, yeah, anyone can misuse anything. So the idea of self-compassion could be misused as well. So, you know, if it's self-compassion, it's actually very easy. Is it causing suffering or is it alleviating suffering? So if you're avoiding your problems, if you're indulging yourself, if you're like skipping work, if you're procrastinating, whatever, you're actually harming yourself in the long run. You know, we know that. We can see, okay, actually, that's not making me happy. It's not. If you avoid your problems, you know, it doesn't really work. The problems are still there and often they just get worse and they fester, right? Or if we are indulgent, we don't exercise or we don't, you know, take care of ourselves, we're actually in the long term causing ourselves harm. And so if it causes harm, it's not self-compassion. By definition, compassion is about concern with the alleviation of suffering. And that's a very simple test. Is it helping or not? You know? And here's the thing. This is why self-compassion is so useful, because you may ask yourself that question. If you know you're going to shame yourself for the answer of, yeah, I'm just being self-indulgent, you're not going to ask the question. But with self-compassion, it's safe to answer the question. It's safe to, you know, so again, research shows that self-compassionate people take more personal responsibility, or maybe harming others or doing things they regret, because it's safe. Oh yeah, I was being self-indulgent. Well, that's human. Everyone is self-indulgent sometimes. It's not the end of the world. You know, so we can see ourselves more clearly when we have the safety of knowing that we aren't going to just slam ourselves if we do so.
And Christine, what's the link between self-compassion and, say, like setting healthy boundaries in relationships?
Ah, so this is what I'm referring to lately as fierce self-compassion. So self-compassion or alleviating suffering has two main ways we can do this. I call it the tender and the fierce. So tender self-compassion is about acceptance. You know, again, we accept ourselves unconditionally, flaws and all. We're human beings doing the best we can. We also accept our emotions, or we accept the imperfection of our lives. This is the way things are. If I fight against that reality, if I pretend I'm supposed to be perfect, I'm just going to make myself miserable. But it's not only about acceptance, because first of all, some of our behaviors are harmful to ourselves or to others. Or sometimes the behaviors of other people are harmful to us, or the situation we're in, it's unfair or it's toxic or not healthy. And so this is where fierce self-compassion comes in. So sometimes self-compassion is about saying no. You know, again, drawing boundaries. If someone's asking too much of you, it's harming you, it's not healthy, you say no. Or you speak up. Or you fight injustice. Or you say, you know, actually, my needs count too. I would love to help you, but I don't have time. It's not like my needs are more important than other people's, but they're equally important. They count. I value my needs and what makes me happy. And I spend some of my time and energy and resources to meet my needs. And also super important is motivating change. Actually, the number one block to self-compassion is people think they're going to lose their motivation. Fierce self-compassion provides motivation. We want to change. We want to reach our goals, not because we're losers or, you know, we're going to hate ourselves if we don't reach our goals, but because we care. You know, we care about ourselves. We want to be happy. So we're going to motivate ourselves to, you know, leave a job if it's really bad for you, or make a change, go back to school if you need to, you know, exercise more if your body's hurting, whatever it is you need to be happy and healthy. Self-compassion motivates you to try to reach your goals again, but for a more sustainable reason. It comes from love, not from fear.
Is there a compassionate way to make yourself a priority, you know, when you're helping and supporting?
Yeah, well, again, just to really consciously remember that your needs count too. Because not only do they count too, here's the thing about when you're helping other people, okay? We think that we're grumpy and we're burnt out and we're frustrated, and we think the other person doesn't know because maybe we're helping professional. We're very, you know, we don't say anything. The way the human brain works is we have what's called empathic resonance. We actually have specialized mirror neurons whose whole function is to kind of sense what other people are feeling. So like when you're helping someone in pain, their pain is affecting you. You're feeling it inside, especially if you're a sensitive person. And they're also sensing your, you know, mindset. So what we cultivate internally impacts other people. You know, it goes bi-directional. And so when you cultivate an internal mindset of compassion, when you think, okay, I'm just really overwhelmed, I need a break. Or you can do something like we teach a practice where you just breathe in compassion for yourself. You say, this is so hard. I feel confused. I feel overwhelmed. I feel, you know, it's just so intense. You breathe in compassion for yourself. Maybe you give yourself some gesture of kindness or self-care. And when you breathe out for the other. So obviously, you know, it's not only about you, but it's also about you. Usually we're taught it's all about self-sacrifice and don't think of yourself and just give. If you do that, you will run dry, you know. And again, remember, if their mirror neurons are resonating with someone who's burnt out and exhausted, how helpful is that to them? But if they're resonating with someone who feels like resourced, okay, I feel fulfilled, I feel, you know, happy, I feel calm, I feel loved, I feel worthy, then we're helping them as well as ourselves. And that's the way humans work. We really, this is a myth that we're isolated individuals. We're always impacting each other.
What's the best way to have a compassionate understanding with ourselves, especially when life is hard and, you know, there's lots of challenges?
Yeah, well, so there's so many different ways we can practice self-compassion. Actually, one way is just simply physically, believe it or not, because as human beings, we're programmed to interpret touch as a signal of care and compassion. You know, babies for the first 2 years of life, they don't understand language, but they understand, okay, this warm, caring touch from, you know, a caregiver or a parent means I'm safe, means someone cares about me. So, and it works at the level of physiology. Without getting too technical, it reduces sympathetic nervous response, the fight, flight, or freeze response, which like it's kind of raised cortisol, and it stimulates parasympathetic response. So it lowers cortisol, lowers inflammation, increases heart rate variability. Okay. So again, kind of tactical, but we have a lot of research supporting this. So doing something this simple when you're upset, putting both hands on your heart, or touching your face, or holding your own hands, some physical gesture of warmth, care, and support Your body interprets that just like you're a baby and your parent touches you or a friend puts their hand on your shoulder. You know, it helps you feel supported. It changes your physiology. So that's a very simple way to practice self-compassion. And, you know, different touches work for different people. Some people like two hands on a heart, their heart. Some people, that makes them feel too vulnerable. So they like a fist on their heart, like strength and power, maybe with the other hand over it and holding your face, giving yourself a hug, holding your hand. There's lots of, you really have to, it's worth exploring what works for you. So that's one way. Another very easy way is actually really simple. What would I say to a friend I cared about who was going through the exact same situation I am? You know, and if you ask yourself and compare that to what you are saying to yourself, you probably wouldn't tell a good friend you cared about, you know, oh, you're being a wuss, stop complaining. You'd probably say, oh, I'm so sorry, how can I help? You know, you'd be warm and supportive. Or you can also think, what would a really good friend or maybe grandparent, or if you're religious or spiritual person, maybe, you know, some being, some spiritual being that symbolizes compassion for me, what would they say to me? You know, or we can think about what does the compassionate part of myself or my higher self, or however you want to conceptualize it, say to me? So again, there's multiple access points in, and I just encourage people to find, you know, what works for them personally. And then you can say to yourself what a compassionate friend would say, or what you would say to someone you cared about. And that's a really easy way. And then the last way, I'll just give you a lot of methods, is you just intentionally bring in the three components of self-compassion. You bring in mindfulness. And remember, this is hard. You turn toward it instead of away from it. And say, you aren't lost in it, but you're like, okay, this is hard. Got some perspective. So it's part of life, you know, making mistakes or hurting or having challenges. It's part of life. I'm not alone. And then you bring in some words of kindness and support. And so intentionally bring, especially remembering the other two components, can be really helpful, mindfulness and common humanity.
How do you think self-compassion could help in navigating challenging relationships, say with friends and family members?
Yeah, so the first kind of step of self-compassion is really just acknowledging the pain. So instead of, you know, sometimes we immediately want to go into problem-solving mode. How can I make my relationship better? How can I get rid of conflict? So, and then we're skipping over the mindfulness, which is the mindfulness of the pain. So first step is just acknowledging, wow, it hurts. You know, it's hard, it's difficult, and just kind of being with that. So we don't skip over that step. Because we go straight to problem solving, and we don't like engage our heart. Sometimes it all comes from our head, and usually our heads in isolation from our hearts, we aren't as wise. So opening to the pain of it, to your own pain, and then also to the pain of the person that you're in relationship with. You know, sometimes I even think of things like, okay, dropping out of your head into your heart. So instead of just thinking, what could be done differently? What could I do differently? What could they do differently? Kind of dropping into that mode of caring. I care about this person. They're important to me. You know, I want to be happy. They want to be happy. And then when you kind of come from that more heart-centered place, again, often your interactions are better. It means your communications are probably going to be a little more effective, a little more calm. It also allows for more insight to come in, right? So one of the things that happens in relationships when we're triggered, like we're really upset or we're blaming ourselves or blaming the other person, our perspective becomes very narrow. It's like, I'm right and they're wrong. And the only way to fix this is to get them to apologize, right? You know, which they may or may not be open to doing. So our options are very narrow. One of the things self-compassion gives you, first of all, you kind of calm down. Okay, this is hard. Maybe you actually physically may reduce your cortisol levels by giving yourself compassion. And then you can be a little more flexible. Well, maybe there are different ways to look at this. You know, I'm trying the best I can. They're trying the best they can. You know, and then what are some of the other factors that are maybe feeding into this? And our perspective broadens when we do that. And that actually also allows us to have better relationships. So yeah, that's why I'm so excited about self-compassion. It's like this amazing thing that's in our back pocket that's so helpful. It's easy to do. And we just forget or we don't think about it. It makes such a big difference.
Do you know Sharon Salzberg? You know Sharon
yeah,
Salzberg?
yeah, of course. Yeah, she was one of the early people that I didn't come up with the idea of self-compassion.
Oh,
actually, when I was practicing Buddhist meditation. So what I did was like I created a measure and started researching it. But yeah, absolutely. I love Sharon.
We interviewed her on this podcast actually some years ago. Great interview as well. If a relationship is broken, then is there a way to build trust with compassion?
I mean, with the other person?
Yeah, if the relationship is broken, for example, you know,
obviously
when a relationship is broken, it can be a lot harder to meet and to relate and to connect.
Yeah, I mean, so I think any difficult thing, relationships are challenging, they're difficult. I think bringing compassion, again, to yourself for making mistakes, for getting things wrong, you know, even having compassion for your own reactivity or some of the mistakes you made, again, that's human. And also extending that to your relationship partner. Can trust be built? You know, I don't know. It's going to vary situation by situation. But certainly, the more compassion you give yourself, the more trust you can have for yourself. I think, you know, you give your partner compassion. I mean, there may be situations where actually what's needed is to draw a healthy boundary. So what does that trust look like? You know, it's not like, it's different than forgiveness, where forgiveness is, okay, absolve that person. I'm going to just act as if it's all fine. That actually may not be self-compassionate. The self-compassionate thing to do may be to draw a boundary or even to distance. So it just really depends on the situation. But absolutely, the more compassion you give to yourself and other people, again, the wiser you can be, the clearer you can see, the bigger sense of safety you have. You're less ego reactive. I mean, even though the term is self-compassion, ironically, you're less ego focused with self-compassion because it's not really self-compassion. It's like human compassion. I'm a human being. That's why it's so important. That's why I don't use the word self-love, for instance. I mean, a narcissist may have self-love. This is really saying, I'm a human being doing the best I can. You know, I'm no better or worse than any other human being. We're all flawed. We're all trying. We're all worthy intrinsically just because we are, you know, consciousness arising in this human form. And when you do that, it does give you a base sense of safety, you know, because you kind of be recognizing, you might say, even your true nature and the true nature of others. And from that safety, I think makes it easier to rebuild trust. Whatever that looks like. And again, I think sometimes, you know, repair may not always be the right solution. It really just depends on the situation.
Deeply listening to others with compassion is an art, as you probably know. How could people practice the art of compassion communication with both themselves and with others?
Yeah, so I think just really consciously remembering to have compassion for yourself. So we teach a practice for caregivers. I mentioned it briefly, where you breathe as you use the breath as a metaphorical vehicle for compassion for yourself and others. You breathe in for yourself, you breathe in out for the other person. And we also say, you know, give yourself permission. If you're really like struggling, you can mainly focus on yourself if you need to until you kind of feel more stable. But, you know, if you don't breathe both in and out, you need to do both in order to live. So things like that. So we teach them a form of compassionate communication. We call it compassionate listening, where you use the breath. So as you're listening to the person, kind of in the background, especially, you know, if you're really engaged, you don't need to do this. But oftentimes, you know, we think, oh, I want to say something. I want to interrupt because I have this great insight. So instead of doing that, you just like breathe in for yourself and breathe out for the person. It's a way of keeping that sense of connection without interrupting. It allows you to stay more present when you're, because again, you're kind of dropping out of your head and thinking, what am I going to say next? Or what clever thing can I say? And you just drop into your heart, kind of come from this heart center place, breathing compassion in and out. But if you only focus on compassion for the other, what happens is we got little brains in here. We got these little tricky brains that want to take over. They don't want to be ignored, you know, or the one that has that clever idea or wants to interrupt, or sometimes goes off, oh, that reminds me of my dad, and blah, blah, blah. And then you're like tuned out and you're lost in your story about your own situation and you stop listening. So just remembering, compassion it's 360 degrees. You know, it goes in and out. If it's just one way, it actually isn't complete, and it's harder to maintain and sustain.
And Christine, in mental health, how does self-compassion act as a healing tool and even a prevention strategy?
Yeah, so that's one of the amazing things about the research is that it's powerfully linked to mental health. So first of all, if you think about the opposite of self-compassion, right? So which is, opposite of kindness is self-judgment, criticism. The opposite of common humanity and connection is feeling isolated, all alone. The opposite of mindfulness is like ruminating or being like lost in thoughts. So we know that, you know, self-judgment, isolation, and rumination are really the core underlying factors of things like depression, anxiety, you know, shame disorders, eating disorders, suicidal ideation. It comes from these sense of being all alone, being isolated, hating oneself, shame, especially shame. Shame is very sticky. Shame often underlies a lot of mental health disorders. Self-compassion is the antidote to this. You know, when we're kinder, we're less judgmental. When we feel more connected, we feel less isolated. When we're mindful, we ruminate less. And so it's kind of like, you know, we're here and we tip the balance like this. And so it does two things. A, it reduces negative mind states like stress, depression, anxiety, eating disorders. But this is the interesting thing. Kindness, connection, and mindfulness, these are actually positive states of mind. It feels good when you feel compassionate, when your heart's open. And so it's equally linked, like greater happiness, greater life satisfaction, hope, optimism. So it reduces negative mind states, emotional states, and increases positive emotional states at the same time. It like transforms them, transforms suffering into an opportunity for love and connection.
What's the best way like to have a compassionate response to negative emotions, you know, like say like anger or guilt or shame or any of these emotions that, you know, where there's like a lot of stigma in the world?
Yes. Yeah. So just the three components. First is just be mindful of them, be aware of them. I'm feeling, you know, I've been practicing self-compassion now for 25 years. Shame still arises. You know, anger still arises. All these, if they still arise, because these are just part of being a human being. They're built into our evolutionary, you know, response systems. So when it arises, just first of all, be mindful of it. Okay, this is happening. We don't ignore it. If you shove it down, if you try to resist it, what we resist persists and grows stronger. We know that from like psychology. So kind of accept that it's here. This hurts. I'm having this difficult emotion. So mindfulness. Common humanity, you know, again, there's nothing wrong with me for feeling this. It's not just me. This is part of being a human being. I don't have to judge and shame myself more because I'm feeling judgment and shame, right? This is part of being a human being. And then kindness. You know, you could express kindness in so many ways. One very, very easy way, if you're able to identify where you feel the emotion, like sometimes it's a constriction in your throat or pounding in your head or like an achiness in your heart or, you know, like a gripping in your stomach, put a gentle hand there. You know, oh, this is so hard to feel this, you know, like just really be there for yourself in the experience of feeling this difficult emotion. Give yourself warmth and kindness and support. Here's the thing, not to make the pain go away, because that's just another form of resistance and it won't work, but because you're hurting. You give up the fix it agenda, even though obviously your long-term goal is to be healthy, but in the moment, this hurts. I'm so sorry. You know, I'm here for you. You can say things like this. I'm here for you. You know, is there anything I can do to help? It's coming from this place of, this is more the tender self-compassion, right? Especially with our emotions. But then also some fear self-compassion may be called for. Oh, I see. You know, I feel this way because my boyfriend just said that really mean, nasty thing or something again, you know, then maybe also some action is called for. Like maybe we need to have a talk, you know, or, you know, maybe the situation can't continue. So in the immediate moment, there's the tender acceptance, the warmth, and then also remembering that we also need to act to take care of ourselves. Sometimes not. Sometimes it's just the acceptance is all we need. It just depends.
How important is it to trust our intuition and our bodies when living a more compassionate and self-caring life?
Yeah, I mean, so really, hopefully the mind and the body can be allies, right? So what happens if we're just living from our head and we're totally cut off from our bodies is a lot of our stress and our tension and our pain actually gets stored in our bodies. And also, you know, you probably know this, a thought is useful, but it can be tricky and it can tell us stories that we believe that are very limited, very one-sided, don't take in a lot of information. It's often a lot of BS, you know, we have tricky brains. Not always, they can be insightful, we can be wise, you know, a lot of good stuff can come. But if we're cut off from our bodies and we just believe whatever our mind is telling us, then we may be led astray. So you might think of your body or your intuition as kind of coming from this larger field of awareness. You know, I'm getting a little unscientific here, although there is research that shows that the body has some wisdom. That actually we recruit our body to feel emotions. Emotions are you know, giving us important communications that we need to listen to. So feeling those communications or intuition or stuff that comes from kind of the subconscious, not necessarily the conscious rational mind, all that's really important information for us to, again, know what to do, you know the best way to respond in the moment. If one way to think of it is, if you think of your higher self, and who knows what that is scientifically? I don't know, but I know there's something there. So if I, okay, I'll let go of that thought and I'm just going to, okay, what does my higher, compassionate, loving self have to say about this situation? I come up with a different response. Then the first thing is my brain says, this is, you know, so-and-so. And so really, you know, you call it your compassionate self, if you want, your higher self, your large, big self with a capital S, your, you know, Christ consciousness. Some people, if you might think of it that way, it just depends on your tradition and how you conceptualize it. And in some ways, I think it's less important how you conceptualize it, but that you know, the limited rational thinking mind is only one way of perceiving things, which is useful, but it certainly isn't the whole story.
Christine, oftentimes people can experience burnout at work. Is there a way to prevent this through the practice of self-compassion?
Yeah, so I'm actually right now with Chris, my colleague Chris Grimmer, we're writing a self-compassion emergency toolkit for burnout with lots of practices to use. Can it totally prevent burnout? Probably not, because some burnout is just structural, you know, too much work, stressful situation. But it can help you from being like sucked into it and getting so burnt out that you can't get out of it. So first of all, again, acknowledging the pain of burnout, you know, it hurts. It doesn't feel good when you're exhausted and you're, so the features of burnout is you usually feel exhausted, a lot of stress, and you feel cynical and depersonalized. In other words, you used to care about the work you do. And then when you get burnt out, one of the features is you just kind of stop caring, and it can be very painful. So again, just tuning into the pain of that, remembering that you aren't alone. I mean, latest figure, I think like 60% of people, especially after the pandemic, I mean, like people, like the worldwide population, at least people they measured, feel burnt out. So you aren't alone. There's nothing wrong with you for feeling burnt out. And then using kindness to say, okay, well, what do I need? What would help me? You know, sometimes it's taking a break. You may not be able to take a break. Maybe you're burnt out because you have a special needs kid and it's just not possible. Then doing things like giving yourself compassion in the moment, breathing in compassion for yourself. I feel so overwhelmed. Using touch. I'm using other practices to really kind of honor, acknowledge, and give yourself care and love because you're hurting, that helps you be overwhelmed by it. So what we know about compassion, what the research shows, is it's an amazing coping mechanism. So for instance, you know, combat soldiers come back from overseas tours who are more self-compassionate or taught to be more self-compassionate, we're less likely to develop post-traumatic stress syndrome. Burnout and post-traumatic stress syndrome, they aren't a million miles apart. You know, it's like we get overwhelmed and then we start having these symptoms like exhaustion and depersonalization. So if we hold the pain of what's leading to the burnout, the stress, the maybe unfairness, overwork, if we hold that with compassion, we're less likely to be overwhelmed by it, which is what helps prevent burnout. And also helps us get out of it as well.
And Christine, what would you say to people who are perfectionists and can work, say, more than necessary?
So self-compassion is really good for perfectionism, because perfectionism, usually when you break it down, is about self-worth. You know, most perfectionists, the reason they want to be perfect is because they don't want to feel like they're imperfect. If they aren't, you know, if I'm not perfect, then I'm a failure. My self-esteem is lowered. And it could lead people to, you know, so when I was I'm actually not teaching classes at the university anymore, but when I was, it was also the students getting the A minus that came to my office hours, not just getting B's. These were perfectionists, and it wasn't okay to get an A minus. They got really upset about it. And so, you know, what self-compassion does is it takes the self-worth out of the equation. You know, you're just as worthy if you get a C as if you get an A. Your self-worth doesn't depend on getting it right. Okay, but then a student would say, but no, I want to go to graduate school. I need the A's. Yes, you may still want the A's. You may want to be top, but the reason you do it is different. You don't do it because you have to be worthy and you're going to beat yourself up or shame yourself if you don't. You do it because it's important to you, because you care. So for instance, we just published a study with NCAA athletes. So in America, these are college athletes. College athletics is huge. A lot of these people, their scholarships are because they're on the team, you know, the football team or the basketball team, whatever. A lot of them want to go into pros. This is their career. They can't be number two. They have to be their very, very best. And so we taught them how to be self-compassionate toward what happens when, you know, they weren't at the top of their game, when there were problems in their training routine, or they made mistakes, or maybe they lost the game, right? And athletes tend to be perfectionists. But what athletes really want, what they really care about, is getting the information they need to be a better athlete. They're all about constant wanting to improve their game. And so again, we taught them, you don't need to improve your game to be a better person. You want to improve your game because you love the game. You want to be your best. You care about yourself. You want to reach your goals. What we found is teaching them self-compassion actually improved their performance. You know, so it doesn't mean you're going to slack off. It doesn't mean you aren't going to still be the best. But when you take the self-worth out of the equation and you replace that with love, it's love that's the motivator, not fear of being a loser that's the motivator. It's actually more effective. It allows you to see more clearly. When you feel shame, it's really hard to learn from your mistakes. Shame shuts down your ability to learn, because all you feel is like, oh, I'm so ashamed. You want to hide it all. It was like, oh, okay. Yeah, I made a mistake. I blew it. It happens. It's only human. What can I learn from this? What can I do differently next time that would lead to a different outcome? Self-compassion is much more effective in terms of helping us learn and grow. You're actually more likely to get it right with self-compassion than by being a perfectionist and using shame as this like whip to try to motivate yourself.
Thanks, Christine.
Makes sense, doesn't it?
Totally, 100%, yes. Well, I'm definitely learning that one myself in a work in progress. Yeah. How could parents best teach and model self-compassion for their children?
This is a great question. The best way to teach yourself, your kids, self-compassion is to model it in front of them, right? To embody self-compassion. So first of all, just again, at like your kids have mirror neurons. If you're self-compassionate, they'll just pick up on your self-compassionate presence, just baseline. That especially if you do it out loud. So let's say, you know, you knock over grandma's vase, you know, the one you inherited from you love that vase. Instead of saying, oh, I'm such an idiot. I can't believe I did that. I'm so stupid. You do that and your kid's learning, okay, that's the best way to react if you make a mistake. Yeah. So you could use that as an opportunity, first of all, to say, I love grandma. Oh, that really hurt. I loved her vase. So devastated. Well, you know, it happens. It happens. You know, sometimes we're just in a rush. You know, things like this, we break things. Maybe like the other part, maybe I can try to figure out a way to put them in a slightly more secure position or slow down. So I'm not, you know, so you can still do problem solving. But you do it not from a place of like shame and anger at yourself, but just from care. And then your kids learn the lesson. Hey, it's okay to make mistakes. And especially when you actually take steps to learn from them and grow, You know, just because you mess up doesn't mean that you're a mess or that you're an unworthy person. And they really start modeling that. And so that's the modeling approach. But really, from about the age of 7, kids understand friendship. You know, that's kind of the developmental task of early childhood is what does it mean to be a friend? Well, you know, to be a reliable friend, to support your friends, to be nice to your friends, to care about your friends. Well, then you can just make sure when your kids learn about friendship to say, and we also need to be a good friend to ourselves. Are you being a good friend to yourself? Would you want your friend that, would you say that to your friend? Or would you want your friend to say that to you? And so that's really the best context to teach this to kids. We also have this books on self-compassion for teaching it to kids. And through the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, there's some programs, especially for teens, but I think we also have one now for children. So
from your own research, what long-term effects does compassion have, say, on a child's emotional and psychological well-being?
Yeah, so there hasn't been a lot of, like, I'm not aware of any studies, for instance, that followed someone from childhood to adulthood and self-compassion. There is some longitudinal research, longitudinal meaning following people over time, like 5 or 7 years intervals. And it does, in general, lead to, I think there was one with teens as well. There's more research with teens than there is with young kids. But yeah, so it, you know, it reduces stress, for instance, over time, it reduces anxiety, it reduces depression, it increases happiness. Because really what it is, it's this resource. It's a way of coping with the tough stuff, with stress, with pain, with disappointment, with frustration, with physical pain as well. It's a tool we can use to deal with emotional and physical pain. And if we don't have that tool, and we just make it worse by judging and, you know, beating ourselves up, we're just going to make it worse. But if we have a way to hold it, to cope with it, like to kind of what they call regulate our emotions, so they aren't so disruptive. We have a way of dealing with them. Self-compassion, from my point of view, is absolutely essential to skillful emotion regulation. Because if there's no warmth, if it's all up here, because the pain isn't all up here, the pain is also here. And so if we just problem solve, we aren't addressing the pain that our body feels, that our emotions feel. So we need the warmth, the care to hold the pain. So yeah, it's, you know, again, really, I think if I were to have my way, if I were the president, I would like require it as training in all schools and all like medical schools and graduate school. I just think it's a life skill that everyone should learn because it's easy. Doesn't cost money. Doesn't take a lot of time. It's just a shift in mindset and how we approach suffering, basically, that makes a huge difference in our health and well-being.
Yeah, I know in India, they have a minister for yoga. I don't know if you know this or not, but it would be great to see a minister for compassion.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And Christine, can you just chat about the importance of self-compassion, say, in parenting special needs children?
Yeah, so my son's autistic and he's doing great now. He's 21 and he's driving and going to community college. He's doing really well. But yeah, so it was really hard, especially when he was younger. He would have these uncontrollable tantrums. He's very, very sensitive. So it was first of all, it's very useful to have self-compassion for the pain of having a special needs kid. I remember I was actually on my way to a meditation retreat when he got diagnosed. And because I have my self-compassion practice, I knew what to do. First of all, it's kind of sometimes hard to acknowledge when you're a special needs parent, you know, this feelings of disappointment. It's not what you signed up for. It's not the plan you have. And you imagine having a child, you know, you usually imagine a non-special needs child. So I just allowed myself to feel whatever I was feeling, that, you know, disappointment, maybe like a little bit of guilt, like as a little older, was it something I did? You know, what didn't matter. I allowed it all to arise and I kind of held it with mindfulness and love and was there for myself, cared for myself. And then, you know, when I had challenges, again, especially when he was younger. So believe it or not, I actually would help regulate my son's emotions through self-compassion. So autistic kids, they have trouble perspective taking other people's point of view, but they're actually very sensitive to others' emotions. That's partly why they withdraw. They're kind of very sensitive to external cues. And so sometimes they couldn't reach him if he was lost in a tantrum. But if I would give myself compassion for like how hard it was that he was screaming and maybe in public and feeling embarrassed, and it was hard and overwhelmed. And I had put my hands on my heart and I would calm myself down. By the way, when I didn't do that, if I got really frustrated, his tension would ramp up. But then when I would calm myself down and care for myself, he would actually start to calm down. So I couldn't reach him directly, but I could give myself compassion. That would actually help him calm down. And then I'd be more able to reach him directly, you know, by being there for him and soothing and comforting him. So that's one way it really helped. I mean, I think for all parents, but especially parents, and it can be special needs, but maybe, you know, in some ways I lucked out because when my son went through adolescence, he wasn't like surly and back talk me. I didn't have to deal with any of that stuff that a lot of parents do. So parenting can be really challenging, especially in the adolescent period. So I think it's really good for all parents.
I have an autistic brother myself, actually. He's non-speaking, and I've done a lot of work in the area of autism. Well, yeah, so I can totally relate to what you said. Yeah.
And my son, at first, it's funny, when he was a teenager, I tried to teach him self-compassion. And he would say, "Don't give me that self-compassion stuff, mommy. I don't want to accept the pain." He was like all about, he doesn't want to accept it. And I was like, okay, well, sure, you're right. Go, you know, go for it. You know, I was thinking, good luck with that one. But, you know, but now he totally is self-compassionate. He'll put his hand on his heart. He kind of understands that when he's upset, he needs to acknowledge it and be there for himself. And, you know, when he's speaking really meanly to himself, he tries to reframe it. And so he has learned the skill. Again, it's not that difficult.
Christine.
Yeah, and it might be if someone's nonverbal or really a lot big intellectually, you know, a lot of intellectual disability, it may be more difficult. But again, you still have mirror neurons. You're still sensitive to other people. So picking up on the kind of, you know, it sounds woo-woo, picking up on other people's energy, but this is neuroscience. You know, our brains are designed by evolution to resonate with each other. And so we pick up on others' emotions. So that's one way to like help people maybe who are even nonverbal and can't even understand, or I don't know how much your brother understands, but you know what I mean? There are different ways you can help. So when you help yourself, you're also helping anyone who's, you know, in your immediate vicinity through their mirror neurons. It's kind of a cool thing about it. You become a more compassionate presence that benefits
definitely.
Everyone.
My brother, he's very sensitive to energies and people's energies and the way they are. And he can really notice and feel when a person's embodied or disembodied.
Yes.
Yeah, and he doesn't communicate, but he's always communicating, interestingly. You know?
It's totally wrong. I think Simon Baron Cohen actually argued that one of the main autistic traits was lack of empathy. It's not true. Perspective taking, yes, very challenging. My son still has challenges. But empathy, not, you know, just emotional resonance. In some ways, they're so empathic. That's partly why they have to withdraw, because they get overwhelmed.
How could a person who's elderly, especially those feeling the weight of regret, benefit from self-compassion and practices?
You know, in some ways, when you regret something, it may be a place for self-forgiveness, right? And so self-forgiveness isn't just like, oh, well, I was only human, you know. Because if you do that, what you're doing is you're skipping over the pain. So if you regret something, maybe, you know, there's things I regret. Actually, the first thing is you need your self-compassion to hold the pain of that regret. You know, to really feel it, not skip over it. Like, you know, I've made some mistakes in my life. And you have to first just, you know, oof, you know, hands on heart, lots of love. Just feel the pain, acknowledge the pain as the first step. And then you can start to forgive and let go. And you remember, you were doing the best. I was doing the best I can. And with the self-forgiveness, though, also comes commitment, in the sense that maybe that if we've done things that we've regretted, hold the pain of that, forgive ourselves. We also want to make a commitment to not causing harm again. You know, if it's just like you forgive yourself and then you do it again, that's not really authentic. So when you feel the pain to you as well as the other person, it hurt both of you, especially now that you're regretting it, it's hurting you. So the thing about compassion is, one of the other aspects of compassion is it sees all the causes and conditions that lead to our behavior, right? So like, what were the circumstances? You know, you're probably stressed. Maybe you didn't have the resources. Maybe you weren't, your parents didn't model certain, you know, so many things. We like to say it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. In other words, you didn't consciously choose to do something that you regretted. You were usually doing the best you could at the time, given where you were, your background, so many factors. So it's not your fault, but it is your responsibility. And first of all, no one else is going to change it for you. And going forward, now that there's some awareness, we really have to have that fierce commitment to not causing harm again. And if you're elderly, maybe that's not a big deal because, but you know what I mean? But that we can have regrets at any point in our life. So I think, again, compassion is really crucial to that. And by the way, just today, there's a research study that had people like, these were undergraduates, so you're young people, think about something that they regretted they doing. And then they had them write a paragraph of the mindfulness, common humanity, and kindness about what happened. And those people who were got that intervention compared to a control group who didn't were more likely to feel committed to repairing the situation and doing something about it. So it increased personal responsibility. It didn't decrease it, which is kind of interesting.
Finally, then looking back at your life, like, what would you tell your younger self about your own journey of exploring self-compassion?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess I would just say, you know, hey, you're on the right track. I mean, I knew immediately the first night I learned about it, it was like a light bulb moment. I was just like so blown away by how powerful it was. But, you know, I didn't learn about it until graduate school. If I could go back to high school, oh my goodness. Imagine. Kristen, you don't need to spend hours doing your hair and makeup to try to look cool. Your worth doesn't come from being cool. You know, it would have been such, and that's why it's so great that we can teach self-compassion to teens. I would have probably suffered a lot less. I would have made different choices. I would have been more authentic. It would have been less painful if I had learned about self-compassion earlier. So, but better late than never. Yeah.
Thanks so much. And then finally, Christine, if our listeners want to find out more about your work, like, how could they do it?
Yeah, so you can either just Google self-compassion or go to my website, selfcompassion.org. It's very easy to find. And you can take the self-compassion scale, measure your level of self-compassion. I've got lots of free guided meditations. If you like the research, I have a lot of research posted up there. And if you're interested in like more in-depth training, I teach some short workshops, or if you want more in-depth training, there's a link to the Center for Mindful Self-Compassion, which is a nonprofit I co-founded, where you can actually take a 10-week online self-compassion course. Or there's lots of people around the world teaching it live as well. So it's readily available. I also take a course online. I've got it with Sounds True. You go to my website and you'll see there's a lot of resources to learn self-compassion.
Thanks so much for your time. It was a pleasure chatting with you, Christine.
You're welcome. It's been a pleasure for me as well.
Thanks for listening to another inspiring and thought-provoking show of The Health Zone. I'm Michal O'Mahuna. Just to remind you, you can find us on facebook.com/ The Health Zone Show, or you can join our Facebook group, The Health Zoners. We're also on Twitter, Instagram, and Pinterest under The Health Zone. To gain further invaluable resources on health and well-being, go to our website, www.thehealthzoneshow.com. When you're on there, join the Health Zone and you'll receive a free copy of my latest ebook, 7 Ways to Boost Your Overall Well-Being. Finally, I would love to hear any feedback you may have on the show, and even if there are any particular guests or topics which you're interested in, please email me on tunein@thehealthzoneshow.com. Until next time, this is Michal. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a very healthy, happy and authentic week.